Hello, everyone, and welcome to Linux Crazy Podcast. This is podcast number 55. In this podcast, if you have been thinking about giving Linux a go, then I have a real treat for you. Daniel and Nathan, two brothers and Linux gurus, are going to explain to you the reasons they have chosen Linux as their only operating system.
Hi, I'm Daniel, and I am 7 years old. Are you tired of viruses and malware? Is the blue screen of death getting you down? Are you having to reboot your Windows server every few days? Then why don't you give Gentoo Linux a try? It is fast, reliable, and has a vast repository of software available at your fingertips. Gentoo Linux, that's my Linux.
Hi, I'm Nathan, Daniel's twin brother, and I am 7 years old. I think Linux is better than Windows because I like the games that I can play on Linux. Games like Megatron Advanced, X-Moto, Supertux Kart, and Wrathkill. I love these games and I know you will too. Gentoo Linux, the Linux I love.
All right. Thank you, Daniel and Nathan. Great job. Next, I'm going to be talking to my buddy, TK009, alias John, alias Edward, and I most likely will talk about my adventures this past week, trying to get my dual screens working again after a Xorg, GNOME, and ATI driver upgrade. And also, I have been wanting to clone my hard drive. I have a 1 250 gigabyte SATA hard drive, and I wanted to create a backup, and I was looking around and it seemed like the best way to do it would be to go ahead and buy another drive exactly like that one and just clone it. So that's what I did, and I got it working, and I can boot from either drive. So if something happens to this drive, I can boot up and boot the other drive. So, like I said, I'll talk to TK009, a.k.a. Edward, coming up. All right, I'll talk to y'all later. Bye. Hi, Edward, and welcome to Linux Crazy Podcast.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I met Edward. He emailed me. He had listened to my podcast that I described my little home network, and I had tried to create a graphic with the GIMP to try to explain where the router was and where the different computers all kind of play together. And he sent me some very nice constructive criticism and told me about a program called DIA. I think I'm pronouncing it right, DIA, that is perfect for this. So that's how we kind of first started talking to each other. And then he came to the IRC channel, which is on Freenode. It's the # Linux Crazy. And we started talking, and come to find out he lives right close to me.
Yeah, that's pretty much it too. I've been a longtime listener of your podcast, but that was the first time I'd actually sent you any feedback was concerning that particular podcast when you were describing your home network. And when I saw your graphic, and I'm glad you thought it was constructive criticism and not just criticism, I thought of a program that I had remembered in the past for doing stuff just like that, and it turned out to be DIA or DIA. Not actually sure how you say it either.
Yeah, I even tried after the fact you told me about it. I went ahead and created a little graphic just to try it out, and it is perfect for the job. You can even add your own little icons to the graphs or pictures that you create, and you could do just about anything. But it's really nice for drawing lines, and you can move the different objects around on the screen a lot easier than the GIMP, which I tried to use.
Yeah, while the GIMP, I'm sure, is capable of it, it's just the right tool for the job, since you were doing a network diagram, would be DIA, or at least that's how I was thinking of it. And it is a pretty good program. It actually does more than just like network diagrams. I don't know if you looked into it deeper, but I believe you can do some pretty intricate electrical schematics and things like that with it as well.
Yeah, I saw some of the examples when I was seeing how to use the program, and yeah, it looks like it would be very good for electrical engineers, I guess you would say.
Maybe the beginner. Not being one myself, I don't know how advanced that tool would need to be, but it looked like it had the capability for at least a beginning doing that kind of work.
Edward, when did you first start using Linux?
I first started using Linux, while most people will say roughly back in this time or back in that time, I can actually pinpoint the exact day. It was the 13th of June, 1998. I actually started out using Red Hat 5.0, which was codenamed Hurricane, which is, probably a good name for us that live in Florida, and just moved on from there. Right now I use Fedora as my desktop, once, of course, Red Hat moved into or split off and created the Fedora project, and that's the desktop I use now. But originally I started using Red Hat.
What version is Fedora up to now?
Well, the current release is 10, however, on June 2nd, they'll be releasing Fedora 11, which is codenamed Leonidas. There was a little bit of a delay. It was originally scheduled for the 26th of May. However, due to some blocker bugs, as they're called, they really wanted to make sure it's mandatory, actually, that those are cleared up before release. And so there was a 7-day delay, which is now June 2nd.
Do you have any involvement with the Fedora project?
I volunteer my time as a triager for the bug triage team. Nothing really exciting. I can't say it's a huge contribution, but it's my little bit to the project. I enjoy doing it. It's really opened up the Fedora community and the greater community to me. I really like doing it.
A lot of the Fedora developers, I guess, work real close with the Red Hat developers. I guess Fedora is almost like a testing ground for the future releases of Red Hat.
It is. I know some people don't like to define it that way, saying it's a test bed for the Red Hat commercial product. It is in some ways, and it's not. There's definitely technologies that you'll see in Fedora that are only going to be in Fedora, although it is also, I think, fair to say that it is a proving ground for technologies that may end up in Red Hat.
How do you prepare for when you go ahead and do an upgrade to, like, let's say, from 10 to Fedora 11?
Well, me personally, instead of doing just like the upgrade method, which has become a lot better, or at least that's what I'm told, I don't actually use that. I prefer to do a clean install. So for me, it means a backing up of my data that I have now, which I've accumulated since the last 6-month install. The woes of being a Fedora user, I guess, is that if you want to stay on the most current release, then you'll be installing every 6 months. Generally, I just take my home directory and just secure copy it via SSH to my home server. Although not a big deal in itself, it's kind of time-consuming, and, you know, as a user, we like to say to ourselves that we're going to keep all of our files and everything in order, and it'll be a nice, smooth move over, but there's always a little bit of cleaning up you need to do before you actually do that copy. And that's pretty much what I've been doing this week, actually, getting ready for the release. And move the entire home directory over to my server. Once I've done a clean install, I go ahead and just move the home directory back. At least for me and my setup, it's as simple as that to back up and running again. Some of the pluses to moving the entire home directory, of course, is that a lot of my specific user configurations are in fact saved, and they're there again in the new installation.
Have you run across any problems with, like, new versions of the configuration files that are in your home folder? When you go from one,
that can be a problem. I personally haven't run into any, but maybe I'm not the extreme power user and have a lot of exotic setup in that regard, so I don't really see a lot of problem, though that is a possibility that doing what I'm doing, if you have something particular to your system and your use, you could run into a headache doing that. Usually they're fixable, though. I mean, it's nothing catastrophic. It shouldn't be catastrophic, so anything can be worked out, but it might not always be as smooth as you like.
What other adventures have you been up to with Linux lately?
Well, recently, like I said, since I'm doing the backup in preparation for installing Fedora 11 once it's released on my main machine, I've been testing it as well on my test machine, although I don't really need any testing anymore. I'm ready to go ahead and move it to my main system. I've been using Arch on my test system now, and I really like it. I like the different approach and different way of looking at Linux and a different approach that the distribution takes. It's something I'll probably play around with long term. It won't be, just a short 1 week review of it. I think this is something that'll have for quite a while to come now.
What version is Arch at now, the current version?
I believe, and being very new to Arch, the distribution, I believe it's called 2009.2 to signify February of 2009. However, it's got a lot of similarities with the distro you run, Gentoo, in that it's a rolling release. So there is no regular release schedule like the kind you would find with Fedora, where every 6 months there's going to be a new release. With Arch, just like it is with Gentoo, you pretty much start with the base system and build just the system you want from there, and it's always going to be as up-to-date as you want it to be without a need for a new download and new installation.
Yeah, I think it starts out, like you said, similar with Gentoo. It's probably just like a very minimal install boot CD, basically, to start the installation, and then it downloads everything from the network. Is that pretty much how it works?
Yeah, it comes with it from what I gather, and like I said, I'm new. I may be saying these things incorrectly. It's just a base install that you can get from the CD. They actually have two versions. One they call Core, and the other they call FTP, which would be network. If you have a slow connection, you'd want to use like the Core, and that way it would install most of those base packages off of the CD. However, if you use the FTP version, then of course it just goes and it's more or less just a bootloader to go ahead and get things started, and it downloads everything from the net so that you have the latest packages to begin with.
And how much trouble was it configuring, doing all the configuration?
Well, surprisingly enough, being spoiled and very used to the ease of installation of Fedora and distros like that, Ubuntu, I did expect a little bit of a hurdle in that regard. I knew that everything has to be set up, that you need to build that system the way you want, and therefore there are no preset user settings, user desktop, nothing like that. Everything is what you decide that it is. Remarkably enough, it's very easy to set up. Looking at their wiki, They have a really excellent wiki. If you follow the instructions on that wiki, I believe I had a running system, desktop and all, ready to be productive in about an hour and 40 minutes.
Wow,
which I thought was
cool.
Really good.
Yeah, the difference, one of the differences between Arch and Gen 2 is that Arch, I think, uses binaries, which will install faster naturally. But you choose which binaries to install, and some of the time consuming in Gen 2 is it actually compiles each, you know, package from start to finish. So compiling each package takes time.
Yeah, I can imagine that would, especially, I think that's Arch's, if I'm understanding it correctly, is just a step in between there. It still offers a lot of the customization and the ability to build a system that's unique to you, that's a system you want, that has only the software you want on it, maybe with not as much of the complication as or the time consuming that the compiling every package, you know, entails.
I used to install Debian and used to just use the minimal install CD. I think they call it like a business card or something like that. And you would install just the base system. And that way you get a really streamlined system as far as you're only installing what you need. But you have to do some work yourself. Now, if you want something like a Ubuntu, or I guess you say Fedora is similar. I'm a little bit familiar with Ubuntu. The advantages of it is you don't have to worry about too much about the legwork as far as configuring everything. But the downside is you're left with a lot of things that you may never use.
Yeah, I'm a Fedora user. I love Fedora. Don't get me wrong, but there is bloat there. And I think maybe a new user might not mind that, but a more experienced or a power user is really going to want to better fine-tune a system. Gen 2, I think, really is for that kind of user, and I think Arch also is for that kind of user. Somebody who really, they know what they want in a system, and they want to go ahead and fine-tune it. With Fedora, I believe I could get the same streamlined system, but it's more of a working backwards instead of, you know, whereas Arch is that very nice minimal base to work on, and nothing's ever going to be installed that you didn't want. Fedora would be more, there's a lot of stuff installed I have to take out.
One of the advantages I've seen with Gen 2 as far as when you start with a real minimal install is that sometimes you can find out where your problem is because you know you just installed something, and then if you have a problem right then and you know that you're the one that did it, you can kind of, it's easier to figure out what actually happened. Sometimes with other distributions and I just press a button for an update and something breaks, you kind of don't really know where to start looking at because maybe it updated a whole bunch of things.
Well, yeah, there's been some people who will say that in certain main distributions, Fedora, Ubuntu, that there's been a dumbing down of the desktop. But I think that's more just a natural evolution of the desktop. While certain users may want that configurability and the advanced features, some may just want to use their system, and I think that's really who Fedora and Ubuntu cater to, is those who are not looking to configure every single aspect of the system. They're happy with the defaults that those two distributions provide.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the middle ground as far as, I used to be hardcore where I would use Fluxbox and stuff like that. And here lately, in the last few years, I've been using GNOME mainly because I like the kind of the look of the GTK apps, the more of the flat look than like KDE has. But I like it when I just put in a USB flash drive and it automatically mounts on there. Or if I want to burn some CDs or something, it's got a nice little GUI application that I can do it with. So a lot of things I still like the doing it the old-fashioned way, but then there's certain things I like doing the GUI GUI way.
Well, you know, it's always important as a user to, I think, especially a lot of new users will be hesitant to use the command line. And I think it's always important to know how to do those tasks via the command line, how to mount a USB, how to mount a CD-ROM or, you know, a USB drive or something, external drive. However, there is, you know, I think even you and I, as you've just stated, sometimes we'll want to better utilize our time than typing in the command to mount a CD-ROM or a USB. It's just more productive when the operating system can do that for us. You know, some may see that as dumbing down, where I see that as just allowing us to invest our time in something that would be more productive.
I recently installed Ubuntu on this. This girl wanted to install Linux. She was getting fed up with Windows, so I said, well, I'll put Linux on it for you. And I didn't even think about installing Gentoo on it because, number one, she was very new Linux user, and that would just be turning her off to Linux altogether. But I knew Ubuntu would probably, she would be able to run that. And I was really impressed with how the ease of how Ubuntu got everything working on that laptop. When you install Gentoo on a laptop, it might take you a week. I mean, I might be exaggerating, but really to get everything working correctly as far as, I mean, everything like the fingerprint reader, the wireless, the getting the video card working properly, and sound on laptops a lot of times can be a problem with the new HDA Intel drivers. And everything installed just perfectly. And also, I was very impressed with the network manager. I even tried the network manager. I plugged in a USB modem that I have that I use to, it's one of those laptop connect cards that I use at work. I work out of a trailer that doesn't have any internet access. And I plugged that USB modem in and it connected right off the bat. So I'm kind of caught in between the two worlds as far as there's certain things I want a lot of control over, and then there's certain things that I just soon just not even fool with, like that USB modem, because doing it manually is a lot of work. Once you get it all figured out, it doesn't take very long to connect, but just putting all the pieces together, because there's a bunch of different files you have to put in under et cetera PPP to get everything working together correctly. So it was very nice the way that worked with Network Manager.
Well, I think that's, every Linux enthusiast, which I definitely consider myself, we like to tinker. So there's going to be times and things where we want to tinker, and I think there's a lot of distributions that allow that for us. And then there's going to be times when, for whatever reason, it's not going to be the best solution. And, you know, something like Ubuntu that's install and forget practically, that it's nice to have those choices. And I think that's the great thing about Linux, is that it offers us as users those choices. For yourself, you can use Gentoo on your home machine, but you needed something that was a little more flexible, a little more, you know, forgiving for the new user, and Ubuntu fit that perfectly. See it myself. I'm also a GNOME desktop user. I do like the fact that the USB will just auto-mount. I think that's, you know, back in the day, we all had to hand-mount that. Now there's no reason to do that manually. It just doesn't make sense. It's not productive. And I think, you know, things that have changed in that way are positive for Linux, instead of being a negative, or as some people might think, dumbing down the desktop. You know, as I think your time would be better invested learning and writing Python than it would be typing the commands to mount and unmount your USB or CD-ROM or, you know, whatever the item may be.
Yeah, I guess that's the whole idea behind the computers, is that, you know, to automate tasks that, you know, would take you, you know, longer to do manually. So that's all just good programming, I would say. It's just stuff that you just plug it in and it works, instead of having to individually do it over and over and over and over and over again.
It's just, you know, technology moving forward. There's no reason there's a, as I said, it's valuable information for all Linux users to know and be comfortable with the command line, but it doesn't mean that that's the way it should be done regularly. If, you know, if that task can be automated, and I think that they've done a good job with that. I don't personally have any problems mounting CDs or DVDs or external drives, cameras, anything like that. Even my BlackBerry connects to my Linux box just fine. So I don't miss the days of typing those commands in.
Yeah, I know. It sure is nice when you plug something in and it just works. I'll tell you, you don't have to investigate why it didn't work. Before I would do anything, it would take you an hour to investigate how somebody else did it first, so you could figure out how to do it.
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, there were a lot of things that just, you know, getting your desktop just to work back in the day was not so simple a task. And there was a lot of learning involved in that. I think, you know, now, as I said, I think your time is just better spent learning other things. Like in your case, I know you invest a lot of time into learning and writing Python. And I think that's, you know, that's where your time is better spent than these mundane tasks in the operating system. I mean, it is, after all, supposed to be a tool to help us, not to hinder us.
I have a lot of stuff on my home drive, and I've been thinking about, and that's about as far as it got before, was thinking about creating some kind of a backup system to back up my home drive. And I think I heard Russ talking about it, and it kind of sparked my interest. So I went to and checked out Clonezilla because I wanted to back up my hard drive on another hard drive, or just see what the options were as far as a backup system. So during my little investigation, I found that it would be a good idea to maybe get another drive exactly like the one I have. I have a Western Digital SATA drive that's 250 gigabytes, and my home directory has about 50 gigabytes on it. So, and I wanted to create something that, in case something drastic happened, that I would be able to just go ahead and boot up on that hard drive. So I got the other hard drive and I installed it. And I downloaded the Clonezilla, which is a live CD, not much unlike a System Rescue CD or any of the other ones. And went ahead and checked and made sure that the hard drive was recognized by my BIOS, and it was. And Linux, my first hard drive is SDA, and the second hard drive is SDB. So this would be SDB, the drive that I'm going to clone drive A to drive B. So I went ahead and booted up the live CD of Clonezilla, and in there are some options as far as, I guess it'll do a lot of different stuff as far as creating images and backup images, and I mean, you could do a lot with it. It's not too much unlike like Norton Ghost and some of the other proprietary options for it. So one of the options was to go ahead and just clone a drive from one hard drive to the next hard drive. So that's the option that I took. And when I went ahead and did it, it went ahead and created the partitions. So I have three partitions. I have a boot partition, a swap partition, and then on my system, I have one partition that's just everything else, which is root and variable and my home partition and everything. It's all together. So set it up to go ahead and copy, clone the whole thing. So it went and cloned the boot partition in about 10 seconds. It created the swap and that, and then it created the last partition. And then it started its copying, and it just stuck there. It just stayed there. It didn't have like a progress bar or even any kind of like a throbber where anything like that. It just sat there.
There was no indication of the status of it, of what it was doing?
No, it It didn't say anything. It said that it had started, but and there was three dots there. But after the three dots, it just sat there. And when I was on IRC before talking to Russ about it, I told him about how big the dry was. He said, well, it should probably take about 15 minutes. So I waited about 15 or 20 minutes, and I didn't see it doing anything. So I thought maybe, you know, something had messed up and everything. So I hit Control-C and backed out of it. And then I rebooted the computer, and I looked to see on that other drive, and I come to find out it had created the boot partition, and the boot partition looked like it was an exact copy of the other boot partition. Oh, and it had asked me during the creation of the boot partition if I wanted to copy over the master boot record, and I said yes. So, and the swap partition was there, and that third partition was there. So I said, well, maybe, you know, I'm thinking maybe I just, you know, bailed out too quick and didn't have enough pay. I don't have much patience, so maybe I just didn't have enough patience to go ahead and
just didn't give it enough time.
Yeah, but while I was there, I just went ahead and used DD myself to copy it, and all I did was now all I need is, this was partition number 3 that I needed. So I just did DDF equals device SDA3 and then of equals /device SDB3. So basically, I just copied that one partition over. And the main thing you got to watch out for, and everybody warned me when I was reading up on this, you know, that the first if is the one that you don't want to mess with. That's the one, and the second one is the one that you're going to. If you'd ever get those two drives reversed in that command, you would end up with, I guess you would end up with two blank drives, I guess.
I think that would be it, too, if you copied a blank drive to a blank drive, or to a full drive to clone it, I believe you'd get a blank.
Yeah. So when I did that, again, DD did. I don't think DD gave me any indication either, but maybe it did. I think it did give me some kind of indication of what it was doing. But it took about...
I suppose, you know, if worse came to worse, you could just look in your processes and see either one of those running and know that they were, in fact, working.
Ah, yeah.
Didn't get an indication in the actual command line terminal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure somebody's probably already mentioned this to them, but if not, maybe it's something you'd want to mention to them on their own bug tracker.
Yeah. So once I did that, then I went into the grub menu, which is under boot, grub, and grub.config, and I went ahead and added a entry for the backup. So I just called it Gentoo Backup, and I just copied over the exact same commands that was in my original grub config. I have like 3 entries in there. I have the latest kernel, and then I have a backup kernel, and then I have one backup kernel so I have 3 fallbacks. What happens is the first entry is the newest installed kernel, and the second entry is the one right before that, and it's just, this all does automatically when you do make install when you're compiling your own kernels with Gentoo. And the third one is an actual
Fedora, actually. It, the same thing occurs in Fedora. The latest kernel will be the mm-hmm. default boot, and below that was the one previous to it, and below that the one previous to it. And whenever a new kernel is introduced, it updates the list and knocks the last one off.
Yeah. The only difference with mine is the last one is mine is hard-coded into a known working kernel, you know, so it's one of my older ones that, you know, it doesn't change, but the first two change, same as Fedora. So I created an entry for the second hard drive, and I went ahead and rebooted, And I boot into the second hard drive, and it booted up just fine. It was exactly the same as the original. And so that all that worked out fantastic. So I wanted a way to keep this relatively up to date. I didn't want to set up something to back up the entire disk, because with Gen 2 it's pretty easy to keep the. I could always update the major main installs, but what I wanted to keep current was, like you were talking about, backing up your home directory. So that's basically what I wanted to keep current. So the best tool for that during my research I found was the rsync. And the first time I ran it, it took a while because evidently the first time it has to go ahead and sync all of your files.
Yeah, it does a complete backup or a complete copy of all the files that you want. And then after that, I guess it does incremental. Only those files that have changed will it copy over.
So I ran it again just for fun. And like you said, it took 2 seconds the second time, so because nothing had changed naturally. So I went ahead and set up a cron for it and et cetera. Cron.d, cron daily, which is pretty cool. There's like four different, you can have cron daily, cron weekly, cron hourly if you want. So it just, you can just put any kind of a bash script in there and it will execute during those times. You don't really have to set up a special cron tab for it. It's pretty neat, really. So I just put this in there, rsync, minus or slash AH, and then my home David to mount backup home David. And I created an et cetera fstab. I created a mount points for the two partitions over there, which is boot and the regular, the whole partition, like I said. And so I created those two mount points. So when I boot up my regular, when I boot up from SDA, it'll go ahead and mount those two partitions so that when, I didn't really need to mount boot, but I did anyhow, but I needed to mount the other one so that when this cron thing ran, you know, when this rsync, if it would, it would be syncing to a drive that's not mounted otherwise. So this way,
yeah,
everything's
done. Yeah,
we know
where to go.
Yeah. So this way, everything's done automatically. So just for fun, I made up a little test text file and put it on my desktop. And this cron runs at 3 a.m. at night. So the next morning when I booted up, I booted into the other side, which was the backup side, just to see. And, yep, that file was on the desktop, so I know it's working.
So you've managed to actually automate the update process as well, along with this cloning of the drive and cloning of all your data.
Yep, yeah. It keeps my home partition backed up, you know, daily. So that's pretty neat. So that's solved.
So would you recommend then CloneZilla? I know there's a lot of other people out there that are in fact recommending it, based on your own use of it. What do you think of it? Would you recommend it?
Yeah. Yes. I think they go to extreme lengths to make sure that it's safe. Which is, I guess, the main thing when you're fooling with existing data on a hard drive. And for me, I was really nervous. I think that's why I went ahead and bailed out that first time and didn't have enough patience to let it go ahead and do its thing. I probably should have just left it alone and come back, you know, in a few hours. But, you know, you get awful nervous when you're fooling around with your existing data on your hard drive.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that. You don't want to lose that data. And I'm not sure, I mean, I don't know how CloneZilla could actually, I don't know. You're right. There's too many ifs there, and I just don't have the knowledge to know. I'd be nervous myself.
But it worked just fine. And it did, it copied the master boot record and all that for me. I had seen in some of my travels that there's certain commands that you can use to go ahead and do that. But like you said, this kind of automates the task instead of having to do it all on the command line yourself. this is they've already figured out all the hard stuff for you.
Yeah, and that's really what you'd want. The ability to clone the drive is excellent, but to also keep that data current, that's really what you need. And I think, you know, with the rsync and that, you probably got it, you know, the right balance for what you need over there, especially since, you know that it's, you've already tested it, you know that it'll boot just fine, you know that your, as I said, your user configuration files and that aren't going to get lost, and that's really one of the biggest things when you're setting up a new system is setting up all your own little personal settings. It's just great to have those files already there.
I set up in my home network. I have one of the first little projects I did was setting up a little FTP server with one of the old computers that I, in fact, I think I found it out on the, somebody's throwing it away on the, out in the street on bulk garbage pickup day, and I put it together and got it working, and I created this little FTP server as one of my first little projects as far as I wanted to learn networking, and that was one of my first little projects to kind of learn it. And that's how I used to kind of try to keep backups was, you know, just uploading, you know, different, like, I wouldn't do my whole home, but I would do, like, you know, GNOME settings or my Firefox settings and stuff like that. But a lot of times you would forget, you know, because that you have to manually, you know, do.
Yeah,
and
you
I
just
would
can't
forget.
Remember everything you've touched. You know, the configure, you may have touched something, you know, once, forgot about it, don't even remember how you set it. It's nice to just back that up rather than, you know, what files do I need. The rsync is great in that respect because it's going to do incremental backups now for you. Any one of those files that you change, it's not even necessary for you to remember. Rsync is going to back that up for you on your second drive.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. I use, Thunderbird a lot for my email, and one of the big things I had before was is that, like, when you install on another machine, you know, I would go in there manually, and I was manually, like if I got another laptop or something, I was manually going in there and setting up all the email and everything, and later on I found out all I had to do was just copy the entire Thunderbird directory. It's actually called .thunderbird, I believe, and I just rename it to Thunderbird because if you put it on a USB stick, it won't. I don't think it was showing up because it had the dot in it. I think that's why I changed it. But anyhow, oh, I know what I would do. I would create another folder called Thunderbird and throw the .dot file inside it just so I could find it. And now I've tried it and it works. I didn't know if it was going to work or not, but I tried it. And all I do now is before I even start Thunderbird, I'll take that whole file, that whole .dot file that has all the information in it, and stick it in my home directory, and then it's already there when I start Thunderbird. The only thing you have to watch out for is when you save it, make sure that Thunderbird is closed. And you can do the same thing with Firefox too. Maybe a lot of other stuff that I'm not aware of. But you just have to make sure it's closed because otherwise there's a lock file inside there. But if you have it closed, you can save the whole thing, stick it in your home directory on another computer, and it's got all of your settings already there.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what I do when I make the backup of my whole home directory. It's saving all those .dot directories and .dot files, which are, of course, the .dot signifies that they're configuration. I think I have that correct. All the .dot directories and files are configuration.
And the other thing I was been, I say wrestling, but it felt like wrestling, was I was wrestling with my dual monitors. Here about a month ago, I took one of my other monitors that I have on a backup system, and just for fun, I hooked it up on my main computer just to see, because I saw these screenshots of other people with dual monitors. So I was like, whoa, that's cool. And with my learning Python, I've always got Vim open, and it was taking up the whole screen playing around with Python, so I was actually running out of room. So I hooked this other monitor up. At the time, I was using an ATI video card, and I hooked the other monitor up, and I did ATI config, and it did everything.
It worked.
It asked me for if I wanted dual monitors. I believe that was the question, and I said yes. It was a thing on the command line. I said yes, and I logged back in. I started X again, logged back in, and darn if the monitor didn't work perfect. So I didn't think any more of it. I just kept doing my thing. So here about a week ago, I updated. GNOME went from, I think this is when it happened. GNOME went from, on Gen 2, GNOME went from 2.24 to 2.26. It went, parts of it went about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I believe the last of it was here real recently. And I'm not sure if that's what did it, but it might be. And also, there was some, I don't think I updated X.org, but I might have. I might have missed that one. But anyhow, all of a sudden I noticed that the second screen, there's one you call primary, and then I guess the other one that's a secondary screen, or left of, mine actually is left of. I got my primary and then left of screen. And I noticed when I opened up apps in that screen, I could open up apps in that screen, but they were all opening in the main screen. So that wasn't doing me any good. It was almost like just a placeholder. I mean, it looked pretty, but I couldn't do anything with it. Anything I opened up, Firefox, anything, I couldn't even open up a terminal in there. And I couldn't drag anything across from the primary terminal to the other one. I couldn't drag Windows over to it.
So it was basically serving no function at all except to light up.
Yeah, exactly. So I searched and I wrestled with it, and I tried reinstalling GNOME. I tried reinstalling X.org. Then somebody said it was, I think it's called Xerema. Xerema, is that how you pronounce it? X. I don't. It's the.
No.
It's X I. Something. Anyhow, it's. They said we'll put that in your use flags. It's the old way of doing dual screens before they have the way of doing it now or something. Anyhow, they said, well, but it still uses that. Put that in your use flags. Xerama. Xerama.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with it vaguely.
So they said, well, put that in your use flags. With Gen 2, you actually put any kind of support you want for when you compile all this stuff, you put support for different stuff. So the base install or the base profile that you could create is the one I use is called Desktop, which has most of the common stuff in it already, that so you'll have support for the common stuff. But any other stuff that you want support for, you have to actually put it in your etc. make.config file. And mine's huge. I got a bunch of stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I put that in there, and I recompiled X.org. I recompiled GNOME. I recompiled everything I could think of. And it still did it. It was just, didn't change anything.
It
so this
up,
was about.
It didn't work.
Yeah, it was doing the same thing. So it was about 11 o'clock at night, and I gave up on it. And I guess I was thinking about it overnight, and I had this Nvidia card up on the shelf. It's a 9800. It's a good video card. It's got one gigabyte of RAM in it. And I think it's a 9600. But it's pretty recent. I just bought it on Newegg about, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. I bought it because it was on sale and it's pretty cheap. But I haven't been using Nvidia. I was using ATI cards because I was trying to get away from proprietary drivers, and I wanted to use open source drivers. And I used to use the Radeon hard drive with this computer here. And then I guess with the latest X.org, I'm up to X.org 1.5 something. The Radeon hard drive driver didn't work with this particular version of X.org. So I had to start using a proprietary driver anyhow.
You mean like the Radeon HD driver?
Right. Yeah, the Radeon HD driver. So I was like, well, shoot. And I was tired of fooling with it, and I love these dual screens. I mean, it's the cat's meow. So the heck with it. I'm going to, eat my words about not using Nevada anymore, because I so I installed that Nevada card, and I had to go through some work because I had to install the Nevada drivers, and I had to make up a completely new xorg.config file. I first tried using X, and then capital X, and then you use a space, and then you use a minus sign configure, and it creates a default file for you, and it did that, but I was booting into a blank screen.
Go
ahead.
When I do that, that's something actually I did recently in Arch. You do the capital X space dash configure or capital X org space dash configure, and it creates that common generic Xorg comp for you. And then what you do is run NVIDIA dash configure as all one word, and that adds the extras that get you going.
Oh boy, I wish I'd have known that. I should have went on the Arch Wiki. Yeah.
That's it.
So it went up to a blank screen. So what I did was I with the new Xorg, you can almost boot with a blank file. A lot of times you can get away with it. So what I did was I just made up a very minimal Xorg config file, just basic. And with the new Xorg, you don't have to put your mouse, you don't have to put the keyboard, none of that. All that's being...
new with Xorg is that it should run without an Xorg.com. I think the reason, those of us who want to use proprietary drivers, we have to use the Xorg.com. So like I have it inside my Fedora install. I have it in Arch. However, had I used like the Intel open source or ATI open source or even the new NVIDIA open source driver, which is excellent, by the way, I would not have had to have the comp file, the Xorg comp file, because that is the new way of Xorg, is to not need that file any longer.
Like I said, you don't need the keyboard or the mouse. That's all handled by Dbus now. What I did was I just made a little minimum one, and then I was able to get Xorg to run. So I booted into Xorg, then I ran Nevada settings, and then once I ran Nevada settings, it set up all the stuff for me, like you said, all the stuff for the proprietary driver. Then all I had to do was just add the directories for my fonts, and that was it. And now it's been working fantastic. The only difference is when I was using the other the ATI one, I guess I had it set up it set it up for me. I didn't really do anything. I guess it was a mirror because I had a taskbar on both screens,
Yes, a mirror of the screen to have the secondary mirror the original.
And this one here is I actually like better is it's all on one side. The taskbar and the window, that bar on the bottom is all on one side. And the other side is completely open that I can do anything with, which I kind of like better than the other way it was.
Yeah, where it stretches the screen across both monitors and then doesn't take away any screen real estate on that secondary one with a panel or things like that, icons.
Yeah, right, because now let me see what the resolution. It's actually the resolution is called 3,360 by 1,050.
Yeah, it doubles the width and maintains the height.
Right, right. So I like that though. That's pretty cool. And it's what's neat is you can drag everything across. You could drag, drag all the windows and everything back and forth anywhere you want to. And another thing I noticed is I guess people already know this, but it's new to me is that When the one screen is full, then the stuff opens up in the other screen, and you can force it to open up in the other screen, I guess, if you want to. But it's pretty neat. You can stuff opens up wherever it's kind of
declutter as much as possible where it has space.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. And
yeah, it was. I think I feel bad now that you didn't know about the, you know, after running the X-Space dash configure, that it was NVIDIA dash configure to go ahead and complete that. But yeah. The one other thing you said, too, and this may be it, clearly you're a communist because you have yours set to left and mine is set to right.
I think that just has to do with the way people's eyes work. You know, my eyes kind of go, I don't know, left seems like is the extra for me. Right is not. That's funny how that works, you know.
I think it may to, you know, I, judging from my own space now as I look at mine, being a right-hander, and of course that's where my mouse is, it, left would be probably more advantageous space-wise. However, my current desk will not allow the monitor to be on the left, so it's right or nothing.
Yeah, well, I think mine, that had a lot to do with mine too, because the actual open space when I did this was on the left. You know, so,
yeah, you see, I got a feeling that that's the primary decider there. You can't help, you're a communist. It's okay.
And let me see, what else I've been doing? That's pretty much, that keeps me pretty much busy. The other thing I was going to mention is that I've been learning this Python that I've actually only been putting out about a podcast every 2 to 3 weeks. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to put out a podcast once a month. So that way it gives me enough time to put together some topics and do a little research and, I don't know, make it a little bit easier on me. So,
well, were you intending, when you mentioned the Python, were you intending to add more Python content to your podcast?
Not really, because I think what happens is that you can't really, I mean, how much can you talk about Python? I mean, if somebody's not really interested in Python, you can only talk about it so much. I kind of try to keep it, you know, alternating from different stuff, because Python, I found out, is really, it just takes a lot of time. I mean, and you really have to be kind of dedicated to it in order to be interested in it, because if you're not really interested in it, I imagine it could get pretty boring listening to some knucklehead like me talking about Python all the time.
Well, you know, I'll admit that that's originally what brought me to your podcast. I mean, I wasn't a Python programmer. I'm still not one by any sense and, you know, any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, it was that content that originally brought me. I am obviously a Linux fan. I listen to a lot of Linux podcasts, but it was that specific thing. And one of the things I like about the podcast, especially the video ones, is where I see a little clip of, you know, like how you start your recording for desktop and voice when you make a screen capture of your desktop, when you do something like that. I think it's those little neat tricks that I see every now and then that, you know, I didn't even know myself that keep me coming back. I kind of like those things.
Yeah, I really enjoy doing the screencasts. They come in handy when you're doing like that, when you're doing something on the command line, especially because it's sometimes hard for me to explain what's going on, and I kind of have a hard time explaining anyhow. And then on top of it, if the discussion gets too technical, I'm not a very good technical speaker, so sometimes it's way easier for me just to show what's going on than it is for me to talk about it. And with the doing the screencast of the terminal is okay, because the terminals are actually pretty small. I do them, I got it down to where I do them. I forget exactly what I do them at, but it works out to be a good size for an actual screencast.
Yeah,
you know, so that we
640 by 480.
Yeah, so it plays in it'll play on any screen, and it'll play in all the players, in player or anything really, it'll play, and you'll get a halfway decent picture out of it. It would be nice to make screencasts of a complete desktop, but I tried that before. I could make them, but you can't hardly see anything. By the time it's crunched down, you know, to that size, a person can't really see too much anyhow. So they really only work for, you know, when you're doing stuff that you can do in a small area.
Well, now here's a trick I heard for doing that. I don't know how well it would work. However, now that you are a sellout and you've become a freedom hater and you're now using a proprietary driver, just kidding, you could try out CompIz. And one of the effects CompIz has is the ability to zoom in on your desktop. So when you're doing a screencast that would require your whole desktop, but then you'd need to zoom in on a specific part of that desktop, you know, for instance, the terminal, so that they can clearly see what you're typing in the terminal, CompIz would allow you to do that on the fly. I've heard that's exactly how people are doing it.
Wow, yeah, that sounds cool. Boy, something else I got to learn.
Yeah. Now, you sound just like Russ did earlier today in the IRC when you were explaining to him about updating his Gen 2, and he said, it's not something else to learn.
That sounds really neat.
Yeah, you know, it. I know a lot of people, they can be down on CompIz, and there are a lot of bugs in it. I won't deny it. I have it installed and the capability to run it, but I don't regularly. But there are some features of it that can be helpful. It just depends on what you're doing, and, you know, not all of it is eye candy. Some of it actually can be productive.
When it was first coming out, and then it went to a CompIz Fusion, I've used it a few times, and I even follow on the CompIz mailing list, and at the beginning it's fun, you know, because it's pretty cool, and then it's nice to show, especially you show Windows users.
First time viewer of the Linux desktop, it's the eye candy that blows them away.
But I just like kind of, like I said, I like everything just kind of flat, and, you know, I don't really care for.
We're both GNOME users. Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah, that's me. So
that's me too.
But that CompIz seems like that would be something good to be able, because now I could load that, just, you don't have to load it every time. I could just pull out and probably just load CompIz when I was going to do a screencast like that, and then unload it when I got done with it.
I think you could do that. One of the bugs I noticed myself, and this may be particular to, I was using a kind of community version and not the Fedora version of CompIz. While I could start it just fine when I wanted to do stuff like that, shutting it down wasn't quite that simple. Usually it involved rebooting to really shut it down all the way. Now, that may be my ignorance and not knowing exactly everything that I needed to kill, but, you know, just going to the icon and saying stop running it, it doesn't, as one of the bugs that I've noticed. But it, and another thing probably to keep in mind is that when I went to the Fedora user developer conference in January, they had the desktop team talking, and a lot of those developers that develop for Fedora, they are upstream. They are the developers for GNOME. So things that you're going to see in Fedora, things that they were talking about at the desktop discussion at the FUDCon, though, you know, that's going to happen upstream. And one of the things is that CompIz is probably going to have a lot of competition. If you're a KDE user, there's of course KWin, and if you're a GNOME user, they've started to integrate their own 3D and effects within the desktop itself. So,
well, that's the best way to go.
I think a lot of people agree with that. I've seen a little bit of unhappiness with the CompIz people about that, the fact that they feel like they're being left behind, that GNOME and KDE are both working on their own versions of eye candy, 3D effects, and, you know, things of that nature. And what I saw at FUDCon, they actually had a demonstration. There's actually a video. You can watch the the video of that talk from FUDCon. It's on Fedora's wiki site. They showed some of the new effects that are coming, and it has all the capability of CompIz. I think one of the problems CompIz has had is that while it is that great eye candy, it's also terribly buggy. I hate to say that, but it is. And they hadn't really shown an ability to, you know, really take, you know, get rid of a lot of those bugs, fix a lot of those bugs. And I don't think that either the KDE team or the GNOME team would be thinking the way they are right now had CompIz been a little more solid than it is right now. Plus, I think there's also some internal problems within the community itself. That's what I hear from the outside, so if I'm wrong, don't blame me for it.
Yeah, well, I follow the CompIz mailing list, and on there you can see it's pretty much the way they're talking. It's pretty much been dead for a while, or the actual project has been dead for a while. And what happened was is that kind of same thing that Gentoo gets kind of complaints about, but Gentoo's been better lately as far as the foundation has a real good solid foundation, is that CompIz didn't have like I forget what they call them, but it's like one guy that's really in charge, that is really, you know, you go to and answer to.
They just didn't have anybody to really lead the project. Is that really what you're trying to say there? That there
was
no strong leader?
They call them benevolent dictator, they call them.
Yeah, I thought that's what you were going for there, the benevolent dictator.
Yeah, so what happened was everybody was doing their own thing. So if you got one guy that likes, I don't know, rotating desktops, he's working on rotating desktops. If you have another guy that likes flames on his desktops, he's working on flames on his desktops. And then some of the more mundane bugs were just getting kind of pushed off to the side, like you were talking about. So
there was also the problem, as you said, there was CompIz, and then there was the Barrel project. And I think that, you know, it was like a forking. I don't totally understand it, so I know I'm not saying this right, but that's really, you know, there was Fusion, and then CompIz Fusion came together. As I said, there was the Barrel project. There was like a kind of fracturing of the community and fracturing of the development that, you know, had that all stayed together, I think CompIz would be in a much better place. But due to that fracturing, we have what we have now. Now, I know that, you know, it's now called CompIz Fusion, and if you go to their outdated website, which I have recently, you know, they talk about how they brought the two back together. But like I said, there was also that Barrel project, and it, you know, the plugins, I guess not everybody's on the same sheet of paper as far as plugins for CompIz are concerned. It's a shame. Like I said, I know a lot of people will just call it, you know, wasteful eye candy, but there are some things to it that are, in fact, very productive. And it's a shame if we were to lose the entire project.
When you were talking about the ability of it to zoom in on the desktop, that almost sounds like some kind of a accessibility thing. There might be another program that I could use for that, you know, like, because there's got to be something for accessibility for people that can't see that well to be able to zoom on parts of their desktop.
There is that Magnify thing, but I don't believe that it has quite the capabilities. From my understanding of how the CompIz one works, it's on the fly. You see your mouse go to where you want it to go, you click, and it just expands right away. I know what you mean. I thought of that myself as I said it, that there are, you know, there's magnifiers. There must be, you know, 10 or 20 of them for just that thing, for accessibility. I don't know that they have the same kind of capability. Like
I'll
said,
have to check in.
When I heard about it, and it wasn't even a solution I was looking for, just, you know, other people were talking and I kind of caught wind of it. That was what they mentioned as the solution for that particular problem. And I didn't hear anything about anything else. Not that it wouldn't work, but it's my guess is that it works really well.
I'll have to check into that because I, you know what, I when I was doing those, and the reason I didn't do the like I said, the full screens, I never even thought about magnifying parts, certain parts of the desktop. It never even crossed my mind.
You know, that's me and my using Arch now. I want to stretch out into the. I've been, you know, using Linux for a long time, but I've been kind of my own island, and there's a lot of great people out there, great information out there, and I'd like to expose myself to more of it. I think using Arch is, you know, just one step in that direction, just like my participation in the Fedora project. And as you know, I'm starting to try to get more involved here locally with the local user groups and that.
Yeah, tell me about the you went to one of the meetings, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to the well, I went to two different events, we'll call them. I of course went to the Ubuntu Miami. I don't know how you say that right. Ubuntu Miami Loco release party for Jaunty Jackalope, and then of
Okay.
course I went to the Florida Linux User Exchange meeting, which is of course our local LUG meeting here in Broward.
Right. You said the Miami Ubuntu coming out party was actually in Port Lauderdale, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, surprisingly enough, it was. It was in, I would have called it actually North Fort Lauderdale and not even the center. So it's kind of funny that they're called the Miami Loco and had the event there. It wasn't too bad. There was a couple people there. You know, they were talking tech and talking Ubuntu. It, the things you'd expect at that. The venue could have been better, in my opinion, but you know, you do what you can with what you got. All in all, I thought it was a pretty good release party, and I thought it was cool of the people to go ahead and take the time and the effort to put that on. Now, as far as the Flux meeting goes, this month there was a discussion on Fedora Directory Server, which is, you know, something that interests me, of course. It may not be of interest to new users, but definitely anybody who's in the corporate world that uses Linux or, you know, that's their job. That's going to be something of interest to them. It was a pretty good it was a good turnout. I think there was 15 or 20 people there. There was some decent snacks. You know, there were some Edamame cookies and such. You gotta love the snacks. And you know, the people were all pretty friendly, and I thought the actual presentation itself was pretty good. There was a technical hurdle at one point in it where we all decided to take a break, and as I looked back inside the presentation room, I realized that the presenter was in fact reinstalling Fedora Directory Service. I felt bad for him. That took him about 30, 35 minutes to get done, but he handled it pretty well, and he still put on a good presentation, even though, you know, his software didn't quite make it.
What actually is that?
It's, I suppose, the best. If anybody's familiar with the Exchange Server, Microsoft Exchange Server, it's, I suppose, it's a way of saying this is Red Hat's version in an attempt to compete. I don't think it's anywhere near that stage. I think almost everybody will tell you that it, when you need Directory Server, that's what you get. But, you know, it's definitely a decent piece of software, and I know that it has a lot of that functionality if it's not quite ready to be a true contender.
Yeah, I have absolutely no experience with
It can, you know, I guess the easiest way to explain what it can do, and I'm sure it does much more than what I'm about to say, but it's basically like, just as the name implies, it's a directory server. So it's, you know, in a company where you have, you know, a couple hundred employees or such, all their information can be stored in that server. For instance, their name, the name or their extension for their phone, their email address, and it also is a way for them to authenticate. So, you know, say you have multiple servers on your site, and you need users to be able to authenticate with all of these servers. they can do so through directory service. They can use just that one server, and that will be the authentication for all these other servers, you know, be it email or storage or, you know, whatever it is. And then you're, of course, able to really fine-tune that to say specific users will, of course, only have specific access to this or that. Or, you know, in the corporate world, I believe that when you have once you reach a certain size company, you need this kind of software to really keep all that stuff together. I mean, just think how hard it would be to, you know, you have 100 servers and Mary over in sales needs access to all of them. Are you going to go to every one of those servers and now create, you know, create access for Mary? Or, you know, with the directory server, it's able to automate that process and keep it in one location. So when you give Mary that access, you're just going to do it on the directory server. It's going to go ahead and propagate to all the other servers. It's, you know, it's an administrator's dream just to, you know, automate these tasks that are mundane and that could, you know, depending on the size of your operation, take forever.
And that's all done over the network, right? So you're like your home, your whatever directory you keep your files on would be actually over the network on another computer.
Yeah, you can do that as well. Exactly. You know, it could be when Mary from sales authenticates with the directory server, it knows that, you know, server 23B has her home directory in it, and that's what she should get. But that was, you know, that was what the talk was about. Like I said, it was pretty good, and even though his directory server died in the middle, he still gave a really good presentation, and I know for sure I want to go regularly because I had fun.
Good. How many people were there?
You. Like I said, about 15 to 20.
Yeah, I'd like to go sometime. Like I said, on Thursdays, it kind of hits me because I have something else I do on Thursdays, but I'll sneak away one time to go with you. I would really enjoy it.
Yeah, it seemed like a pretty diverse group of people from all aspects. I mean, I know there were some that were university student. One guy was a university student. The other guy worked in the medical field, and, you know, so it's definitely a diverse group.
I'd probably get some good leads for podcasts there.
Yeah. And I'm sure that they, you know, like I said, there's a lot going on there. You know as well as I do, because we actually follow it. We're on the mailing list. It's not as much of a Linux lug as you'd expect. You know, to me, a lug is, you know, they're promoting Linux, they're doing install fest, they're really helping users with, you know, just getting, installing, and using Linux as their primary function. The lug isn't quite that way, because to my knowledge, I've never heard of them doing an install fest, or do you know what I mean? Something along those lines. Well, when this particular night, the night the meeting was on, one of the attendees brought his laptop, and I know you would have seen the email as well, some kind of problem. Could somebody please bring a bootable CD and help the guy with the problem?
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you saw that email. So I ended up doing is I brought, Fedora 10 live. And then I, what else? I brought a System Rescue CD. I thought, you know, just in case, we'll cover our bases and bring two. What it actually turned out to be was the guy had a brand new purchased copy of Mandriva 2009, whatever their latest version is, and a Dell laptop, and he just wanted to install it, and he didn't know how. Now, this, like I said, this is where I was a little disappointed, but it's only because I think they just need a little more participation, you know, here locally. We didn't do that. And, you know, there was the presentation on the Fedora directory service. I'm not quite sure accurately which one that is. But, you know, I thought that we should have also been installing that Linux on that laptop during that presentation, and that didn't happen. Now, what I ended up doing was giving the guy my email address and my cell number and said, you know, hey, if you need somebody to talk to, you got questions or something, you know, go ahead and give me a call. Because before the meeting happened, apparently he has ATI as the graphics card in this machine. Mm-hmm. And it would not initiate the live CD, you know, wouldn't initiate and run because of a graphics problem. And, mm-hmm. of course, it didn't, you know, I'm not familiar with Mandriva. I'm sure somebody who is knew right what to do. But, you know, my first thought is, well, we got to go into text mode. But there didn't really seem to be a way to get into text mode. You know, the function keys didn't seem to be putting me into, you know, a virtual terminal or anything. So what I did is I just grabbed my BlackBerry real quick, and while we were standing there, looked on Google and found out it was a no ACPI or something similar to that. There was a, you know, give it that setting, and it'll go ahead and go from there, and we got him going. And I know he worked on it a little bit more during the presentation, but I know he didn't get it installed because he actually emailed me the next day and said, you know, he was going to try and work on it over the weekend, and if he had any problems, he would email me again. And that was pretty much what happened at the local meeting. So it was interesting.
Yeah, sounds fun.
Yeah, I know you would have enjoyed going to it, and, you know, maybe you could have helped the guy even better than I could have to get his machine running. Like I said, I was a little disappointed because I really think that we should have had that guy with Mandriva on that system by the end of that meeting.
Yeah. That would have been nice. Now, that's the whole idea of the open source is, you know, helping out the other poor guy. You know, that's how we all got to where we're at now, is by, if nobody was there helping us, we would still be, I don't know what we'd still be doing.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's the little things. It's like I said, it's the little snippet of code that you use to copy, or, you know, to when you're going to do a screencast and capture your desktop. That was something I didn't know. It was, you know, my little idea about using the DIA or DIA to make the diagram. It's, you know, getting out there among them, I think it's kind of like Linus says, more eyes on the problem make the problem go away.
All right, Edward, I'm going to go ahead and have to say goodbye.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on your podcast, and I look forward to listening to this one and them in the future, and I'll talk to you on IRC.
All right. Thanks a lot, Edward. We'll do it again.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye.